From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A drumbeat this week ramping up tensions with Iran. Is war on the horizon? President Trump answered that question yesterday. Also yesterday, the White House unveiled what it calls a new merit-based immigration plan. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the proposal condescending.
Are they saying family is without merit? Are they saying most of the people who have ever come to the United States in the history of our country are without merit because they don't have an engineering degree?
And Alabama banned nearly all abortions this week. Alabama Pro-Life Coalition President Eric Johnston told NPR he welcomes a challenge to the law. He's hoping for a national review of the legality of abortion nationwide from the U.S. Supreme Court.
We want to stop abortion of unborn children, and the only way we can do that is to go back and revisit the Roe decision. So this law is, in effect, a vehicle to do that.
You can join our conversation. What do you make of the administration's new plans for immigrants to the United States? What questions do you have about growing tensions with Iran? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm excited this Folkenflik Friday with this week's roundtable. With us from Washington, Jennifer Epstein. She's Bloomberg News reporter covering the 2020 Democratic campaign trail and a past White House reporter. Jennifer, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, David.
And also with us from Washington, D.C. is Susan Glasser. She's staff writer and columnist at The New Yorker, a global affairs analyst for CNN. And Susan's also a past editor-in-chief of Politico and Foreign Policy magazine. Susan, great to have you as well.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Jennifer, and Susan.
So let's start with the unveiled immigration plan. President Trump unveiled his immigration proposals at the White House Rose Garden yesterday. He made these remarks.
Today we are presenting a clear contrast. Democrats are proposing open borders, lower wages, and frankly, lawless chaos. We are proposing an immigration plan that puts the jobs, wages, and safety of American workers first.
Jennifer Epstein, can you walk us through a little bit what the president seems to be proposing here?
Well, what the president is proposing, and this was a plan that's very much also being credited to Jared Kushner, is to focus more on what the administration casts as merit-based immigration. So people who have certain kinds of job offers, who would have higher salaries, not people who would be farm workers or working in manufacturing, would be favored in the immigration process. It's not at this point something that would cut legal immigration numbers. It's just something that the president and some of his allies have at times talked about, and we've already heard from some of the more conservative immigration groups saying that they're disappointed that this first offer doesn't also include a cut in legal immigration, because they just don't see how in any kind of negotiation this would end up, you know, being favorable to their point of view. This is something that does not actually talk about the issues at the border right now. It does not address the issue of Dreamers and whether they would get some kind of permanent status, whether it's citizenship or pathway or something else. It also doesn't get into the people who have temporary protected status, so people from countries that have had various kinds of humanitarian crises, and something that the Trump administration has struggled to deal with. They've offered some extensions to TPS status, even after they said they were not. Temporary protected status. So it's a situation where the administration seems to be, you know, picking out one sort of piece of the puzzle, but not actually getting into some of the more complicated things that the president, even in that clip you just played, seemed to be taking credit for doing. You know, that Democrats want open borders, he said, but he's not actually dealing with the border issue in what he's proposed at all. Obviously, there are other parts of his policy agenda that have to do with the border, namely the border wall and efforts to increase enforcement at the border. But this does not get into that at all. And it is something that also seems to be pretty much dead on arrival in Capitol Hill. Democrats don't really see it as a great negotiating point. and they don't seem to think it's necessary to do so, because you even heard Mitch McConnell yesterday saying that it was not something that he really was thinking much about. And in general, Republicans were not really that receptive
so,
to
so
it.
This is Jared Kushner's kind of grand Susan Glasser, his grand immigration plan. He's been appointed by the president, his father-in-law, to come up with all kinds of things all over the world. But this, I guess, one of them. He's, in a way, you think it might be on the surface pitch to appease everyone and no one. That is, it's not drastically reducing immigration, has been proposed by various administration officials since Trump took office. But it's also very much shifting our understanding of the way in which immigrants come here. How big a shift would a plan like this represent?
Well, look, I think it's right to point out the role of the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, in this. And I think that underscores what a fundamentally and deeply unserious proposal this is. It doesn't bode well for Mideast peace, the next Kushner plan that's due to be rolled out sometime quite soon. But, you know, as Jennifer pointed out, it's dead on arrival. Both Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill viewed this as not a serious proposal. Why? Because it doesn't, as Jennifer pointed out, address many of the main issues, such as the border, that actually has been a fairly obsessive focus for President Trump. It was done so quickly and haphazardly, they weren't able to fully brief Republicans on Capitol Hill on what was actually in the plan. As the clip you played suggested, it seems much more aimed at political positioning than any actual legislative intent. And even there, I should, you know, just as a matter of fact-checking, it's laughable to say that Democrats' immigration proposal is open borders and increasing
right.
crime. I mean, come on. That is not serious. That shouldn't be played as if it's on the level description mm-hmm. of the president's
also cutting wages.
Opponents. Exactly. Oh, yes. Cutting wages, too. I mean, this is silly stuff. I mean, come on. You know, whether you like or you don't like it, sadly, the bottom line is that there was a moment in time when Republicans and Democrats actually did agree more or less on an immigration reform agenda. It was back during the second term of George W. Bush, also a supporter of comprehensive immigration reform. To mm-hmm. me, that's always been the great what might have been. President Bush, when he was reelected, chose to go ahead with a sweeping and ultimately unsuccessful Social Security reform proposal. Imagine if he had made immigration reform his top priority and done that while he still had the momentum of his reelection win. It's, of course, an unknowable, but in all honesty, that's the last time there was a serious prospect of immigration reform, and it's not going to happen now.
Let's turn our thoughts to Iran. There seemed to be a drumbeat of support of ratcheting up tensions with Iran. You heard that from certainly the corners of John Bolton, the national security advisor of Secretary of State Pompeo, it seemed. I want to play a couple quick clips. Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas spoke with Margaret Hoover on the PBS show Firing Line Wednesday. Here's what he had to say there.
Could we win a war with Iran?
Yes.
That didn't take you a second.
Two strikes, the first strike and the last strike.
What are the conditions or the circumstances that would justify going to war with Iran?
Well, if Iran struck out militarily against the United States or against our allies in the region, then I would certainly expect a devastating response against Iran.
Now, yesterday in Tokyo, the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said Iran was committed to continuing in a multilateral nuclear deal.
We believe that escalation by the United States is unacceptable and uncalled for. We have to exercise maximum restraint, as you pointed out, in spite of the fact that the United States withdrew from JCPOA last May.
The JCPOA was the Iran nuclear deal that the Obama administration threw itself behind and achieved, only to have the Trump administration pull out. Jack Beatty, we heard reports in the last 24 hours called it that the president does not want war, that he's been kind of throwing cold water on his own advisors. What do you make of this public tension that we've seen about the question of possible conflict with Iran?
Well, three points. First, Wars arise often from misperceptions in international affairs. There's a classic book called Perceptions and Misperceptions in International Politics that outlines what's called a security spiral, where one nation does something to enhance its deterrence against another nation, for example, perhaps putting missiles on boats, small boats, as the Iranians seem to be doing. And then the other nation takes that defensive action on the part of Nation A as an offensive one, and it ramps up its response. And so you have this spiral of insecurity. That's a danger that could lead to war. The second route to war could come start as early as 60 days from now, when Iran could decide it is going to break out of the constraints of the nuclear agreement, from which we have, we've torn it up, and start enriching uranium to the point where within a year it could have a nuclear capability. That would raise the question of, again, preventive war. Even the Obama administration saying we would go to war with Iran to prevent it having a bomb. Would that be the policy of the Trump administration? We don't know. We do know that preventive war, I think Bismarck's comment on it can't be improved on. He said preventive war is like a man committing suicide from fear of death. Iraq was a preventive war. It didn't work out very well. And then the third point, the president doesn't want war now. That's very clear. And Susan, in her piece in The New Yorker, brings out lots of evidence to that. But the president is facing political storms, and it repeatedly in 2012, he charged that President Obama was ready to go to war for political reasons to help him out. So that's very much been part of his idea of how war arises. Presidents do it to escape from tough political dilemmas such as he may be facing.
All right, Jack Beatty, Susan Glasser, Jennifer Epstein, hold on. We want you all to hold on. We're going behind the headlines with our Week in Review roundtable. Join our conversation. We'll be talking a little bit about new restrictions on abortion and the newest Democrats to enter the 2020 race. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look at this week's top stories. We'll talk shortly about state-level challenges to legal abortion, the ever-expanding pool of 2020 Democratic candidates. We want to hear from you. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Jennifer Epstein. She's Bloomberg News reporter covering the 2020 Democratic campaign trail. Susan Glasser, staff writer and columnist at The New Yorker and CNN global affairs analyst, as well as Jack Beatty, our own On Point news analyst. I want to take a call quickly from Lexington, Kentucky. Austin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot the White House and the administration tossing around the term regime change when referring to Iran. And I wanted to highlight some of my own personal experiences traveling to Iran. I've traveled just as a tourist, had wonderful experiences. I want to highlight that Iranians are, by and large, regardless of what their theocratic government might maintain, Iranians are modern, educated people. There's a saying in Iran that Iran is like a cup of water, and that every 30 years it spills over, and then someone else from outside the country spills it over. Students of history will know that going back to the 50s with Operation Ajax, this is the case, the Iranian Revolution. So I just want to say that if the U.S. really wants to encourage democratic ideals within Iran, the best thing they could do is promote international relations with Iran, promote education, do everything they can to help the people so that they can democratically move their government forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Austin. I appreciate it. Susan Glasser, you wrote a piece posted in The New Yorker this morning, as Jack Beatty alluded to. It's called War Games, Trump, Bolton, and the Alleged March to Fight Iran. And then you say in there, basically, if the president really wanted to go to war right now, we'd probably already know about it. How seriously have you taken this drumbeat that we've heard in the recent, call it, past 10 days or so?
Well, look, I think that, there's a certain amount of predictability, hysteria, even on both sides of this at this point, right? You have, on the one hand, a whole strain of commentary saying, oh, my God, this is just like the run-up to 2003 and the invasion of Iraq, and look at the manipulation of intelligence, and look at the series of escalations and the hawkish advisors surrounding Trump. Then you also have, by the way, among really hard-right conservative opponents of the Iranian regime, a concern that Trump is running the same play that he did with North Korea, that he's actually wants to talk with Rouhani and that he's going to give away this door in negotiations. I think the latter, by the way, is more likely than the former, which is to say it's much more likely that Trump is trying to run the same play of ratcheting up pressure on the Iranians in hopes of bringing them back to the table. Remember, he blew up the Iran nuclear deal because he said that it was the worst deal ever. He was offended as the great deal maker that he portrays himself, that he didn't think it was a good deal for the United States and that it wasn't tough enough by essentially kicking the can of nuclear weapons development down the road rather than permanently foreclosing it and also enabling Iran to continue to develop things that would support a nuclear weapons program, such as long-range ballistic missiles and things like that. So Trump always critiqued it as a deal, not the concept of a deal. And we know from North Korea and other things that he sees himself as a deal maker, somebody who can sit down at the table. Frankly, he's run this same play forever as a business person as well as a public figure. And so I think it seems more likely that he himself is looking to exert maximum pressure on the Iranians in hopes of coming back to the table. I don't think that is exactly the agenda or the analysis of his very hawkish national security advisor, John Bolton, who has a longstanding public record of saying that he's actually in favor of regime change and he doesn't believe any meaningful accommodations really can be reached with the current Iranian leadership.
Kind of makes you wonder a little bit what the president thought he was getting by hiring John Bolton, if this isn't something he wanted to at least pursue. But perhaps it was part of the positioning gamesmanship, right?
Well, look, first of all, a lot of presidents like to have a bad cop to their good cop, first of all. Second of all, the president believes that he's the decider. He has shown no hesitancy whatsoever in getting rid of advisors who challenge him too much or of whom he tires. And so I think he fundamentally thinks these people are staff and I'm the boss.
All right, let's turn now and talk about domestic politics. As mentioned at the top of the show, in Alabama, a law was passed, signed by the governor, that effectively bans almost all abortions in that state. In Alabama, Democratic State Senator Linda Coleman Madison was one of three women senators who got to vote on the controversial abortion bill. She spoke on the floor during a four-hour debate on Tuesday.
This bill is not about pro-life or the right to life. This bill is about control. People are going to have abortion. The problem is it's going to always be unsafe, inaccessible for those people who have lesser means.
Jennifer Epstein, you obviously been covering the 2020 Democratic campaign trail, but let's talk about this. And let's first talk about we'll get into the politics in a moment, but let's talk about what this does and what that means in terms of changing the landscape for access to abortion in this country.
Well, this Alabama law in particular basically creates a system of almost no exceptions. And that is something that has been is unusual. There was an attempt to pass an amendment to exempt rape and incest that failed. So this is really an extremely restrictive law. And I think as the clip you played earlier in the show suggests, this is something where we're seeing a bunch of different states, including Missouri, Georgia, Ohio, several others, in the past couple of months have passed these much more restrictive abortion laws. And it does seem to be a push back toward the Supreme Court that we're headed for. And now that President Trump has two of his appointees there, no longer the same dynamic where it was seen as Justice Kennedy being the swing vote. This may be something that is going to be on the horizon very soon.
And Jack Beatty, what do you make of the politics of this? That is, it seems as though, well, I guess first, before we get to the presidential politics of this, let's talk for a moment about the positioning of this. We heard at the top what a major state anti-abortion activist said to our own broadcast at NPR. The idea is that this was designed, as in fact the governor of the state has said, to force the Supreme Court to try to confront this issue. Is this issue ripe for the Supreme Court to revisit? Is there a sense that a newly conservative majority on the court might well be willing to overturn the precedent of Roe v. Wade?
There certainly is an apprehension that that's the case. That was the subtext of the Kavanaugh and Gorsuch nominations. The president, in the campaign, he basically said striking down Roe v. Wade would be for him a litmus test, if he didn't use that expression, for Supreme Court nominees. But will it reach the court? Legal experts say the most certain route to the court is to have a conflict between two appeals courts. You know, one says one thing, one says the other. The Supreme Court resolves it. They can't see that there would be a disagreement between appeals courts for the simple reason that the law of the land remains Roe v. Wade. And these laws, these cruel laws, are in direct conflict with the current law of the land. Therefore, there wouldn't be a dissent among appeals court. Who knows whether that's true? What's striking here on the political ground is that, as a piece in New York Magazine points out, there is not a single state in the union where according to gold standard opinion polling, they cite, where a majority favors anything like this, making abortion illegal in all or almost all circumstances. In Alabama, only 26% of people favor that. In another poll, 52% of Trump voters wanted Roe v. Wade maintained. So we have a strikingly small, sort of religious-based minority driving this against what does seem to be the national consensus on abortion. And, of course, that makes it a good talking point for Democrats who had been on the defensive because of propagandistic claims about the horrors of late-term abortions that Democrats presumably were charged with wanting by the president and others. So now they can talk about, wait a minute, it's you people, it's your party that wants to break from the national consensus that there shall be abortion, but it shall be regulated.
Let's take a couple of quick calls before we turn back to the political landscape. Sarah is calling from Warriors Mark, Pennsylvania. Sarah, what are your thoughts on this?
Hello, David.
Hi.
The pro-life movement, I think, has been focused mostly on Supreme Court changes for really a long time. But why is the change in the national landscape more toward the state movements to get to the Supreme Court? Because I don't know how some of these laws could work to overturn them. I think the law in Alabama would be quickly overturned. I don't know if that one could really make it to the Supreme Court. How would it get? I mean, how, on what grounds could it possibly get there?
Okay, Susan Glasser, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, look, it's a good question. I'm not a lawyer. What's interesting is that it does seem to be part of their strategy, right? So we can't say, we can't predict what will happen in the courts. But what we can say pretty definitively is that the sponsors of this legislation envisioned it explicitly as a test case that they are hoping to send to the court. What's interesting is that I saw even some fissures within the pro-life movement over this case the other day when it passed and was signed into law by the governor, even some evangelical supporters of the broader campaign against abortion rights saying maybe this isn't the right case to take all the way to the high court. I mean, you know, look, the politics, Jack, did a good job of outlining, you know, have they inadvertently handed an issue back to Democrats, which is to say being seen as too far out of the mainstream with this proposal, that it's an extreme proposal. But look, it just to pull back, right, as a matter of politics, it is an extraordinary thing. It's something that certainly people from other countries have a really hard time understanding in the United States, not only why and how a very small minority can successfully wage a state-by-state and national campaign against something so broadly supported by Americans. But look, it's easier in many states in this country already, even before this new wave of laws, to get a gun, even a deadly assault weapon, than it is to get an abortion.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are those who do support this. The president has been sounding support of what's happening in Alabama. I do want to take another call from Antioch, Illinois. Lance is calling. Lance, share your thoughts, please.
This is a pendulum swing, really. In the last couple of years, at least the last 10 years, Democrats have really gotten strident and pushed the issue of abortion, not only into partial birth abortions. Here in the state of Illinois, our newly elected governor wants to make Illinois the abortion capital of the United States. He has said so. And they pushed the agenda in with Obamacare, wanting to have taxpayer dollars fund abortion care, those demanding to get rid of the Hyde Amendment, and also the president of Planned Parenthood, who said she was proud that she was getting Christians to pay for abortions. You know, science has kind of caught up with many things. We're not living in the 1970s anymore, like Jack was talking about. We now know when life begins. We now know when heartbeats start. We know a lot of scientific facts. But I think part of this whole thing with the Alabama thing, not to mention Missouri, Iowa, and Ohio, is that, you know, it's because of this push of the left not willing to let the consensus stay as it was. They pushed it even farther. They kept demanding abortion into farther and farther and farther along, even where the Virginia governor was talking about, you know, allowing babies to be killed after a failed abortion, which is horrific, not to mention what happened in New York and Vermont. You know, they pushed the agenda too far, and now the agenda is being pushed back the other way.
Thanks, Lance, for your call. I can find that online that the governor Pritzker said that he wanted to make sure Illinois was abortion friendly. I think the characterization may have been one that came from some of the president's critics. Jennifer Epstein, how are Democrats on the 2020 trail reacting to this? To what degree are they wading into the abortion question as you cover these candidates there?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of candidates in this race, but none of them are supportive in any way of these laws. And there's been certainly everything ranging from tweets from Vice President Biden, who hasn't been on the campaign trail for the last couple of days, to a fairly comprehensive proposal from Senator Warren that was unveiled on Friday morning. We've heard from Senator Gillibrand, who's been out there probably more than most of the other candidates for the Democratic nomination. Senator Gillibrand and Warren have both said that basically there needs to be a federal law kind of backing up what is in the Roe decision, because right now there are so many different – the vast majority of states do have various kinds of restrictions on abortions and ways that make it more difficult, and that's something that they do not want to see continue. I think that Senator Booker has also leaned in that direction. This is something that definitely animates a certain part of the Democratic base that wants to preserve these rights. I think most people who are pro-choice say that they're not pro-abortion, but they believe in the woman's right to choose and to have, mm-hmm. An option because of various life circumstances, medical circumstances, and so on, and that a law like the Alabama law that is so restrictive doesn't, take into account the trauma of something like rape and incest is really beyond a bridge too far. Is just something that they just cannot let abide. And we're seeing lots of protests planned. I think that there are expectations. I got an email about things planned in all 50 states this week. It's something that definitely galvanizes a lot of activist energy.
I want to briefly touch on a couple of new candidates. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio announced his candidacy for president Thursday morning. He bequeathed an unflattering nickname on the president, no doubt, because the president does that to so many others. And Montana Governor Steve Bullock has entered the presidential race, a red state Democrat. He says he wants to be one to appeal. Very briefly, Jennifer, maybe 15, 20 seconds. How likely is this popular Montana governor to be able to catch fire in a pack this big?
I mean, it's possible that anybody could catch fire at any point in time. We saw that certainly with Mayor Pete Buttigieg a couple of weeks ago. There's been nobody else who's a new flavor of the month. We'll probably see many. Remember Herman Cain. Remember when Rick Perry was going to be the next president of the United States. And so
we haven't yet gotten to the Baskin-Robbins level of 31 flavors, but I guess we're waiting. We're discussing the week's top stories, from Trump's most recent round of pardons to trade tensions with China and more. Join our conversation. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. In other news this week, we say goodbye to two greats. Film star and singer Doris Day passed away at the age of 97 on Monday. Quite a career. If you've ever sung the word Sarah out loud twice in a row, you know who I'm talking about. And renowned architect I.M. Pei died yesterday at 102. His notable designs included the pyramid entrance to the Louvre Museum in Paris, the East Building of the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. Each is an enduring masterpiece, each worth the visit. You can join our conversation today. We'll be taking a look at escalating trade actions between the U.S. and China and more. Are you being affected for good or ill by tariffs? Let us know. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Jennifer Epstein. She's a Bloomberg News reporter covering the 2020 Democratic campaign trail. Susan Glasser, staff writer and columnist at The New Yorker and CNN global affairs analyst. And of course, our own Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. I'd like to turn now to some of these ongoing legal problems and implications for the president, for the administration, what we're calling a kind of constitutional confrontation, if not a crisis. Most recently, I guess, judge ruled Susan Glasser, that the special prosecutor's team needed to publicly release a voicemail involving former Trump national security advisor Michael Flynn. And there's a question of what kind of messaging he was received. What was going on there, Susan?
Well, it's very interesting. There's actually two calls at issue. And so we may by the way, actually hear these tapes and not just read the transcripts, which would be a significant new level. This is an incident that figures into part two of the Mueller report, the obstruction chapter of the Mueller report. It's one of the 10 incidents that may constitute obstruction of justice, which I think you'll hear a lot more about as the House Judiciary Committee continues to examine this evidence and investigation compiled by Mueller. So in this case, Michael Flynn, as you know, was the national security advisor of the Trump administration. We're now on national security advisor number three. He was number one. And he was fired by the president early on, 24 days into the administration. Eventually, the question of what he said to the Russian ambassador in a phone call and whether he lied about it to the FBI was at issue in the case brought against him by Mueller. He pleaded guilty in that case. For some time, he had a joint cooperation agreement, joint defense agreement with the president. At a certain point in time, he decided to stop that and to cooperate with the special counsel's office. So while that is happening, the president's lawyer at the time, John Dowd, calls up Flynn's lawyer and leaves what seems to be a pretty threatening email, essentially saying like, hey, man, you know, well, exactly, a voicemail. And he's saying, hey, man, you know, the president still thinks highly of your client. What's going on here? Then it becomes clear that there is going to be they can't share information anymore. And Dowd reacts angrily to that, according to the transcripts released yesterday in the court case. And it's really it's quite a dramatic thing that we may soon hear in the words and the voice of the president's own lawyer.
And the idea being that somehow this may play into the question of obstruction of justice, that the special prosecutor decided not to reach a finding on whether or not there'd been a you know, implicating evidence enough to bring a indictment against them for.
Well, again, obviously he can't bring an indictment against the president of the United States. So there's always this question of what the obstruction investigation is properly in the domain of Congress, according to Mueller himself in the words of the report. Attorney General William Barr, as you know, reached a different finding and chose to characterize that publicly, a source of some ongoing dispute. But yes, the implication of John Dowd's phone call to Michael Flynn's lawyer is very clear. It is essentially the president appears to be pressuring a witness not to cooperate with a special counsel.
So even as this is being looked at, even as there seem to be more information coming forward, even as Congress is sort of struggling and trying to figure out how deeply it wants to go into this, the Attorney General of the United States, in some ways at the behest of the president, is looking at the investigation itself and its origins. In an interview from El Salvador that aired this morning, U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr told Fox News Channel's Bill Hemmer that he wants answers for the nation on whether the FBI appropriately handled the launch of the Mueller investigation.
Some of the explanations I've gotten don't hang together. So in a sense, I have more questions today than I did when I first started.
Some of what things don't hang together?
Some of the explanations of what occurred.
Why does that matter?
Because I think people have to find out what the government was doing during that period. If we're worried about foreign influence, for the very same reason, we should be worried about whether government officials abused their power and put their thumb on the scale. And so I'm not saying that happened, but I'm saying that we have to look at that.
The Attorney General also suggested that, in a sense, James Comey, the head of the FBI, then James Clapper and John Brennan, two top intelligence officials, were effectively plotting against President Trump, if to take what the Attorney General is suggesting seriously. Jack Beatty, what do you make of this inquiry? I believe the Attorney General has appointed a U.S. attorney to actually formally look at this alongside, I guess, the Inspector General that's taking a look at this as well.
Well, this is the counter narrative. This is the investigation of the investigation. This is what Fox News and the president's supporters have been clamoring for, and now they have it. And it may serve to cast some shade on certain aspects of this investigation of the Trump campaign connections with Russia. You know, the hiring, sending over operatives to find out information from key figures and this sort of thing. But it also is going to have the effect of putting this again in the news. You know, it's going to be here. We're going to have more and more. We're going to hear the president's side. So it's hard to see what effect this is going to have other than to muddy the waters, which I guess is what Trump wants. And he will have congressional allies. I mean, Lindsey Graham is going to go down this road, too, in the Judiciary Committee. And, of course, the House Republicans are pretty much an arm of the president on this. So we'll just have to see. I mean, I think that the Democrats now are in the position where Nancy Pelosi has been saying that information gathering was going to be in lieu of impeachment. And today she's suggesting that maybe impeachment will be the only way to gather information, because with a claim of impeachment, that is a clear legislative purpose, and that if you need subpoenas, if you're getting into court, that would be an unanswerable claim. So the whole ground of back and forth is shifting even as we speak.
Jennifer Epstein, there's been a couple more developments this week. Donald Trump Jr. was subpoenaed by the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is led by Republican Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina. A lot of his fellow Republicans cried foul, and they negotiated basically for Trump to testify in private for a number of hours about some of his interactions with the Russian. And Trump's White House counsel basically sent a note to Congress essentially saying, we're not going to cooperate as much as possible with your oversight inquiries, not impeachment inquiries, at least not yet. Because we don't think it's necessarily legitimate. What are people on the hustings? To what degree are Democratic candidates willing to engage on this issue?
You know, they certainly do engage when voters bring it up. But for the most part, at least among the leading candidates, there's not a whole lot of impeachment or even investigation talk among them. They're much more focused on their own messages, their own personal stories, and on you know, when they do talk about Trump, it's much more around beating him, I think, with the understanding that, you know, if something else were to happen, if there were to be a successful impeachment, that would, of course, be, you know, one path to get him out of office. But they're also much more, you know, practical and immediate about it in saying, you know, this is my plan to beat him at the polls. But we have heard from Vice President Biden, who I've been covering quite a bit, saying that he does want to see House Democrats go along with all of their investigations and see where they take them. If they do lead to impeachment, then he seems to be fine with that. If they don't, then that's fine as well. And he's, you know, as much as it seems, and we've heard Nancy Pelosi say this a bit, that Trump seems to be goading the House Democrats into impeachment, and because the Republicans ultimately believe that it will be, you know, a losing political issue for the Democrats, and that when Republican voters see the president under threat like this, and you know, presumably if there were to be a trial, you know, you would have the Republican majority Senate on his side, and that this would just galvanize Republican voters to the polls in November 2020. But Biden, for one, says he doesn't believe that, and that it's a situation where the Democrats need to do what they believe in. They need to take responsibility, do their constitutional duty for accountability, and see where that leads them. Mm-hmm. You know, thinks that ultimately standing up for the Constitution is a winning political issue.
I want to move on briefly before we get to the question of tariffs. I want to move on to I want to touch on the question of presidential pardons. It's fascinating. We heard this week that Trump had pardoned former media mogul Conrad Black. Black spoke with the Canadian network Global News yesterday after receiving his pardon. Here he recounted what he said was his conversation with President Trump.
He assured me that the fact that we'd been cordial acquaintances for 20 years and that I'd been relatively supportive of him, which he thanked me for, was not the reason. He was very explicit and very clear and urged me to make it clear that the reason that he did this, his motivation was that it was, and I'm quoting him, a bad rap, an unjust verdict, and that I should never have been charged.
Jack Beatty, this is the third, pardon that sort of caught my eye. He pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who had been accused of many kinds of violation of prisoners' rights down in Arizona, but had been a political ally. He pardoned Dinesh D'Souza, a very conservative activist figure who had been convicted on certain kinds of counts related to campaign finance convictions. What do you make? Black himself was a former business partner of the president who had written a glowing biography of him. What do you make of this particular pardon and what it says about how the president approaches the question?
Well, he certainly likes people that flatter him. And the title of Black's book, Donald J. Trump, A President Like No Other, that's certainly, you could read it in different ways, I suppose. I'm a little constrained here. I helped to edit Mr. Black's book, Biography of FDR, which is
I did not know that.
Very able, very, very able account, very admiring. And all I can say is, to paraphrase Henry Adams on the run of presidents from Washington to Grant, that if you look at the run of presidents from FDR, one of Mr. Black's subjects, to Trump, one of the other, it is the best, it's a pretty solid argument against evolution.
I want to turn now to the question of tariffs and to China. The president has been ratcheting up the rhetoric even as there are some talks ongoing, and we've put tariffs in place, and of course the Chinese have responded in kind. Susan, what are you seeing from your perch about the nature of what this says about the way Washington now looks at the world and looks at trade?
Well, look, I think in some ways this may well be the most significant thing that's happened this week. We began a week ago with the expectation that the United States was actually close to an agreement with China and that talks had been proceeding for months. They had gone on a bit longer than expected and that it appeared that Xi Jinping had already given a public speech saying essentially that the Chinese were willing to make certain concessions on intellectual property and the like that the Trump administration had demanded. Where we're ending the week is in a very different place with very uncertain prospects. Markets obviously very jittery over this because they had expected the two sides to come to agreement. President Trump has actually been quite clear from the beginning that he sees himself as, quote, tariff man. And so it's probably not a surprise that he has imposed tariffs as a major part of his strategy on the economic side. And once you impose tariffs, what economists say is that it's very, very hard to get rid of them. And very unlikely. And so they tend to stay in place in a long time, even if you introduce them on the grounds that this is essentially a temporary bargaining position. So my default setting for a while has been that this is a new policy of the United States. And what we're really seeing is whether and to what extent China will accommodate itself to that. How much does China really need the United States is one of the questions that will get answered. But to your broader question about Washington and has there been a revision in the way that policymakers, politicians here are looking at China. And I think the answer to that is yes, and even in a sort of bipartisan way. It's clear that the previous consensus here of globalization, of integration, essentially, of the Chinese into the global economy on the theory that that would give them much more incentives to be a good actor on the international stage, we've really moved quite far away from that in both parties. And so there's some inherent support, I think, for a Trump policy of being much tougher in negotiations with the Chinese. The interesting thing for him is that he faces a real political risk, he being Trump here, because it's many of the farmers and other voters in red states, states that supported Donald Trump, who are feeling the initial pain from this trade war with China. And how is he going to calibrate that? How does he balance the risk to his own base? He's been almost fanatical in obsessing over this base and the minority of Americans who supported him. Their cries of pain are getting louder and louder. Will he keep up with it?
It sounds like a policy that could have effects that outlast the presidency itself. You've been hearing there the words of Susan Glasser. She's staff writer and columnist of The New Yorker, CNN Global Affairs Analyst. Susan, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
We've also been joined by Jennifer Epstein. She's Bloomberg News reporter covering the 2020 Democratic field. Thanks so much for being with us, Jennifer.
Thank you, David.
And our own Jack Beatty, On Points News Analyst. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from David Marino, our executive producer, Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.